Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. I know there's a lot of sensitivity in the region about people who don't live here, telling the story of life in Appalachia, but sometimes there are advantages to that, and I discovered one while reading The Cancer Capital of America. It's by Suzanne Zuppello. Yes, Suzanne is based on Long Island, but no, she's no stranger to this disease that holds our region in its grips. Suzanne earned degrees in ethics and public policy, as well as healthcare management from New York University. As an undergrad, she published a white paper on the fight for water in the Colorado River Basin and worked on a microloan project in Rwanda with the UN Development Program, and she built potable water systems and taught public health in rural Honduras. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So what brought the attention of a Long Island writer to the cancer situation in eastern Kentucky?
Well, it was in part personal and part professional. So I am a healthcare journalist and read studies quite frequently about the cancer rates that we're seeing across the country, different studies that are coming out as to how cancer is treated in different areas, what's working, what isn't. But I have a BRCA genetic mutation, so I'm predisposed to a much higher risk of both breast and ovarian cancer. So I'm personally involved in the cancer community quite a bit. And so prevention and early detection are really important to me as a patient, as well as a healthcare journalist. So that's how I came upon a study that was discussing cancer rates in rural areas of the United States and how rates are rising. And that's what tipped me off to what work is being done in Kentucky right now.
A lot of eastern Kentucky families go back many, many generations, and there's a sense of pride about being a fifth or sixth or even seventh generation mountain family. But as they say, the same thing that makes you rich can make you poor, and you discovered that to be the case where cancer's concerned. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So like many regions throughout the country, families in eastern Kentucky have been there for a very long period of time. And that means that communities are small and, quite literally, there is no new blood coming into a lot of these areas. And what that has proven in eastern Kentucky is that we're seeing certain genetic mutations cropping up among families in the region because, I don't want to call it inbreeding, but because that's not what's happening, but it's more that the gene pool has become fairly homogeneous. And so when you're living in a region for decades upon decades and families are from the same area, they're carrying these same inherited risks of cancer, for instance, that's going to become a lot more common than, say, somebody from eastern Kentucky moving to Los Angeles and marrying somebody who's born and bred in Los Angeles, where there's a little bit more mixing of blood and gene lines.
Mm-hmm. And what is Lynch syndrome?
So Lynch syndrome is a genetic predisposition that heightens a person's risk of colorectal cancer, of breast cancer, among other diseases. And it's very common in the eastern Kentucky and Appalachia region. They're seeing it much more now because the cancer risks are rising. A lot of the doctors that work with the University of Kentucky system have begun testing for Lynch syndrome, just as in other regions we're testing for other genetic predispositions to cancers. And that's why where some of this great information is coming from and why programs like the ones that are running in eastern Kentucky are becoming more successful, because we know a lot more about why things are happening. It's not necessarily just an environmental cause or just a hereditary cause or diet or what have you. But the more information we're getting about Lynch syndrome and testing people for it, the better equipped we are to understand that if somebody is to walk into an emergency room, say with severe bowel pain and a fever, it might not be an appendicitis as you would assume if somebody walked into a New York or Boston ER with it. You would know that colorectal cancer is very common among people who live in the Eastern Kentucky region, you would know that Lynch syndrome is common. So maybe there would be other things to test for before you would assume what might be obvious based on your medical training.
And you note in the article that a big reason for this prevalence of cancer in Eastern Kentucky is not poor treatment, but a lack of early detection through screening.
Yeah. So what I came to learn as an outsider in Kentucky, and I truly came with an open mind because I do know how frustrating it could be when somebody who is not from your area wants to come and tell your story, is that's been happening, is other people, outsiders, as they were called, or foreigners by some of the folks I met, were coming in and telling Eastern Kentuckians how to live, how to work, how to do different parts of their life. And so there's this sort of embedded reluctance or mistrust of the medical system, which is part of why cancer is being detected later in a lot of people. And it's also simply access to care. What I learned in my time in Hazard was that the surrounding counties, some of them, there are people who come into town once a week or once a month, and some of those counties have one store or no stores or no healthcare professionals. And so access, on top of this mistrust or, you know, feeling like you're being talked down to by medical professionals, exacerbates the late stage of cancer that we're finding in Eastern Kentucky.
How does fatalism play a role in both late stage diagnoses and this aversion to preventative screenings?
From what I've read and from what I've learned of the people I've talked to in Eastern Kentucky, that fatalism is that a lot of people have resigned themselves to getting cancer. And again, because of this mistrust that we've seen and the lack of access to care, which is leading to late stage diagnoses, there are a lot of people who are under the impression, well, if I get diagnosed with cancer, I'm going to die, because every other person I know who was diagnosed with cancer died. So why equip myself with that information when the outcome is just the same? That's the fatalistic attitude that's coming in. And it's an unfortunate one because it really is just a lack of information or lack of understanding of, again, how we prevent cancer, how we treat cancer, how we're able to detect it early, where people don't have to die of colorectal cancer. It's an extremely treatable cancer. Lung cancer can be detected earlier. Breast cancer, for instance, can be detected much earlier. And so that fatalistic attitude is unfortunately not to the benefit of Eastern Kentuckians. And it's also one that's very, very hard to turn around. And what the physicians and the medical professionals in the area are doing, or they're using community health workers to build up that trust within the medical community and educate patients in a way that they understand and that they feel that the playing field is even, that they're being treated as equals, not as somebody who's stupid, not as somebody who doesn't care about their health, because they're not. They're not stupid, and they are people who care very much about their health and the health of their loved ones.
Suzanne, any lingering takeaway impressions that you have about the work that you did on this story?
I just found the resolve of the patients I met and the communities I was in so remarkable. I think that while fatalism was so common in the literature and in the people I talked to, no one's giving up. The people who are diagnosed are using that diagnosis to educate their friends and family, rather than turning it into a sob story that they have. Instead, they're starting fundraisers. They're talking to their loved ones, their colleagues. For instance, Paul Campbell was a police officer that I interviewed, and he was a giant of a man, not somebody that you could ever see break down. And because of him and because of his colorectal cancer diagnosis, the rest of his squad started going and getting colonoscopies and getting screened. And they were of all different ages and people with all different people with different backgrounds and family histories of cancer. And that's a really positive outcome. And he's a young dad. He had a great job. He was very excited about life and still is. And he didn't let that break him. And that, to me, when you work on a topic like cancer as often as I do, is truly the most remarkable outcome that you can see, is people not giving up and people using that diagnosis for to improve the lives of those around them as well as themselves.
Well, in just a moment, we're going to hear about a major effort to grow our own cancer specialists when we hear from Nathan Vanderford about a new collection of essays written by young Appalachians who aspire to careers in the field of oncology. That's coming up in just a moment. Writer Suzanne Zuppello on her article, The Cancer Capital of America. And we thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
We posted a link to Suzanne's article on the facts and information page of our website, esweku.org. In his role as director of the Appalachian Career Training in Oncology, or ACTION, program at the Markey Cancer Center at the University of Kentucky, Nathan Vanderford needed an effective way to get people to really think about the fact that Kentucky is number one in the nation for cancer, and it's heavily concentrated in the 54 counties that make up the area we cover, Appalachian Kentucky. Well, the answer is a book of essays by students in the ACTION program. And Nathan's here to tell us all about that book. Thanks for coming in, Nathan.
Absolutely. It's great to be here, Tom.
So first, let's talk a little bit about the motivation behind this book of essays.
Well, you know, it's really multi-layered, but at the heart of it, it really is what you mentioned in the intro. It's, the major cancer problem in the state. We rank number one in overall cancer incidence and mortality rates. That problem is greatest in Eastern Kentucky. And so this represents thousands of people who contract and pass away from cancer every year. And that data is powerful. But behind all those numbers are people. They're people who are battling this disease. And that impacts them as individuals. It impacts their families, their communities, and the region as a whole. So through this book, I really want to have these students' voices speak to those issues.
And so your mission as director of the Appalachian Career Training in Oncology program, which speaks for itself, is to get out there and find students like these who have written essays who have an actual interest in a career in oncology.
Absolutely. The overall mission of the program is to recruit students from Eastern Kentucky, get them in this program where they're going to be exposed to cancer research experiences, clinical observation experiences, cancer education. We help train them to do outreach in their communities to help their community members better understand cancer and cancer risk factors. And ultimately, we want to provide them opportunities and the means to see themselves as future cancer professionals, either in the healthcare industry, research, in the community, educating people. And we want them to be change agents in the community and help us drastically turn this cancer problem on its head.
And is there also a thought that by being local, being familiar, that they can carry the message about cancer maybe a little bit more effectively than somebody coming from outside of the area?
Absolutely. So, Tom, we're both from rural areas, and we know that rural citizens sometimes can put blinders up in terms of interacting with outsiders or people that aren't from the area. You know, I experienced this in my hometown, rural area. And so, absolutely, I mean, these are students who are deeply embedded in their communities and their youth who have something powerful to say. And we already know through experience that these students are having that people in the communities are listening. And they can be change agents because of who they are and this powerful message that they are beginning to share.
So there are about two dozen of them, I think 25 total, who are represented in the book. How was it working with them?
You know, our students are just phenomenal. They're smart. They're engaging. They're really motivated, driven. These are individuals who want to go on and do fantastic, great things in terms of future careers and radically changing their own trajectories. I'd also say they're frustrated and maybe even a bit angry after learning about this problem. I think too often we don't realize that this is such a huge problem in Kentucky, and that includes these students. And so when they've learned this, and you can get a sense of this through some of these essays, that they are frustrated and they don't like seeing their loved ones taken from them. So that further motivates them to be part of the solution and working toward addressing the problem.
Okay, and as I said, there are 25 of them. All are outstanding, and obviously we don't have time to get into each of them in this hour, but can you highlight a few that stand out?
Absolutely, I'd love to. So, you know, as you said, I'd love to highlight all 25. They're fantastic, but I'll just do a couple. So Natalie Barker, who's a high school student in Elliott County, in her essay titled Cancer in Eastern Kentucky, she talks about a couple, three experiences with cancer. She talks about her great-grandfather passing away before she was born. And she paints this really interesting picture of how he's has this very positive legacy in the family, but that was taken from her. She didn't get to experience him while he was here. And she talks about things of his still being, you know, around, but he vanished and these things are still there as reminders. She also talks about her stepbrother and his battle with leukemia. And then also shares a story about a woman she met in a local nursing home who she developed a friendship with, but then passed away. And it was another experience of someone just sort of vanishing. And the very end of her essay, I'd like to, if I can, just read a couple sentences. She says, Eastern Kentucky is in crisis. We have the highest cancer incidence and cancer mortality rates in the country. And we are not just a scary statistic. We're people. We're human beings just like you. We go to school. We eat dinner with our families. We have birthday parties and barbecues just like everyone else. Yet our loved ones are being taken from us. We're in desperate need of help, not only from the outside, but also from the inside of our communities. And then she goes on to talk a little bit about some roles that individuals have to play in this battle against cancer. Andrew Davison, who's a high school student from Rowan County, talks about his mother's battle with breast cancer. She overcomes that battle. She's in remission today. And he talks about how he and his mother have this strange feeling about being labeled as a cancer survivor, and how it doesn't seem fair for a survivor to be labeled that way when others who fought just as hard didn't quite, you know, they succumbed to their disease, so they feel awkward about that. And then I'll just highlight one more. Lauren Collette, who's from Leslie County, really paints a vivid image of what it's like growing up as a youth in Appalachia, spending lots of time with her grandparents. And then her grandmother develops lung cancer, passes away just right before she graduates from high school. She's the school's valedictorian. So she talks about how, you know, that has been so impactful in her life and devastating to lose someone that she loves so dearly. So, you know, I think just very impactful stories.
Do these essays, when taken in combination, do they reveal reasons why Eastern Kentucky faces such an exceptional struggle with cancer? What are some of the leading factors?
Yeah, students get into that. So that was one of the things I wanted them to cover. So they get into a lot of a range of issues in their essays, but some things that can be lumped into bigger buckets. They talk about access to care issues, from transportation issues, you know, traveling, having to travel long distance to get health care. They talk about financial and insurance barriers, screening, access to screening, understanding screening and early detection methods. They talk about tobacco use quite a lot and other unhealthy behaviors, a lack of cancer education and understanding what cancer is, risk factors, modifiable behaviors. And they also touch on some of our stubbornness related to seeking health care. I think many of us, myself included, sometimes don't go to the doctor as often as we should. And again, speaking as an Appalachian myself, I think that we tend to do that maybe more so than anybody. We tend to ignore problems and don't seek out care when we should. So those issues come up quite frequently in the essays.
Well, Nathan, you work in the field of cancer, but you also have some personal experience with it as well. Do you care to share that?
Absolutely. So I talk about this, I share this story in the preface for the book. So on Father's Day, June 20th, 2010, my dad passed away from lung cancer. He was diagnosed in the November before that, and he was doing okay. His treatments were going okay, and just suddenly that Father's Day, after I had spoken with him that morning, he had a massive hemorrhage and bled to death suddenly. You know, again, just vanished in the blink of an eye. And then a couple months after that, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. She underwent some very successful surgery or radiation therapy, and she's okay today. So this is a very personal story to me. Again, as an Appalachian, I can relate a lot to what these students have to say.
You know, I think it's safe to say, as we were discussing before the interview began, that just about every adult out there is in some way familiar with cancer, up close and personal, or at least within the family.
Absolutely. It's a highly prevalent disease.
Okay, so details. When will the book be available? How can it be obtained?
It's currently scheduled for an April 7th release date. It's available now for pre-order on several different platforms. The one that's probably most accessible is through Amazon. So if you go to Amazon and if you search Cancer Crisis in Appalachia, I think you'll find our book, and we'd love for people to pre-order it.
Nathan Vanderford is director of the Appalachian Career Training in Oncology, or ACTION, program at the Markey Cancer Center at the University of Kentucky. Thanks so much, Nathan.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
A new study led by Markey Cancer Center researchers suggests that implementing cancer education curricula in middle and high schools may improve cancer literacy in Kentuckians and ultimately help reduce cancer rates. For the study, students were given a baseline test to determine their cancer literacy, and that was followed by a cancer education presentation. Average test scores improved by 30%. Even against such a formidable foe as cancer, knowledge is power. Coming up after the break, pharmacists being required to do more and more with less and less.
I can tell you that there have been a reduction in hours for pharmacists in these pharmacies that we're speaking of, and still having the performance metrics could lead to stress, and at a stress level could lead to opportunities that something may happen that was unintended.
And something you need while standing in line at that busy pharmacy.
Patience.
A book on reclaiming this foundational virtue. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
There was a recent New York Times article about CVS and the other big pharmacy chains that dispense about 70% of the prescriptions in America. According to the reporting, these chains are pushing performance metrics, understaffing, and overworking, asking pharmacists to do more and more with less and less, things like counter service, filling prescriptions, catching potential mistakes made by the physician or somewhere in the system, tending to a drive-through, giving flu shots, counseling patients, educating both patients and doctors, and dealing with insurance companies. All of that while functioning under the constant pressure of these performance metrics, which include calling doctors' offices to push for refills. According to the Times article, this has been leading to an increase in prescription errors. And joining us to talk about the details of the article and the findings And how this is playing out in Kentucky is Don Cupper, president of the Kentucky Pharmacist Association. Thank you for joining us, Don.
Thank you for having me.
And is what I described in the introduction there pretty accurate?
It is our understanding that a lot of that is happening today. Hopefully for the good, and I'll define the good as being pharmacists doing more than just dispensing medication, but offering vaccines, doing medication, you know, therapy with them so that they understand what medications there are, what they need to avoid, those types of things. Med reconciliation, a lot of it's done. Some of those things they get additional pay for. So some insurance companies pay when a pharmacist does that.
The Times, for its article, interviewed 1,000 pharmacists around the country. 60% said they feel undue intimidation and pressure to fulfill performance metrics on which their salaries or their bonuses might depend, at the expense of patient safety, often. And you've read the article in the Times. Is it an accurate portrayal of what is really happening behind the counters in these chain pharmacies?
I would say from a certain perspective that I can speak for Kentucky. Being the sitting president of the KPHA, we hear a lot of things that go around in the state with regard to pharmacy. And I can tell you that there have been reduction in hours for pharmacists in these pharmacies that we're speaking of, and still having the performance metrics could lead to stress, and at a stress level could lead to opportunities that something may happen that was unintended. So to be quite honest, I'm not amazed because no one talks about the fact that they may have eliminated a part-time pharmacist or they may have cut hours from a 40-hour week to a 30-hour week. It's a different world. And we've seen in areas as well where the whole management structure has been taken out of a certain chain here in the state of Kentucky. So there's no managers. So when there's no one really offering assistance from a manager's perspective and able to help because there are pharmacists as well, when you don't have that management level in there anymore, it's becoming an environment that's really changed. And I'm not surprised.
Is that management occurring from afar? Is it more of a kind of a centralized situation and we're Kentucky and maybe other states are kind of satellites?
Sure. Well, I would think, I don't think we're much different than other states other than our topography. Our towns are not as large as, New York City, but we still have the same types of patients who have the same illnesses and the same needs. I've been around a long time. I'm not afraid to say I'm in my 40th year as a pharmacist. And, when I started, the independent pharmacy was the name of the game. There were some small chains. Now there's larger chains, and the food industry has gotten into the pharmacy business. So when you see that, that's a realization that, times have changed. Well, they've changed even more because a lot of these pharmacies that grew out of chains were run by pharmacists. Mm-hmm. They were working pharmacists at one time and had been elevated to a leadership position. Today, they're not pharmacists. Today, the pharmacists have retired off. There's not leadership backfilling into those positions that are pharmacists. And many of those folks are business folks that have an MBA degree or a degree from a specialty school, Wharton, some of that nature. And they come in and their sole purpose is to make things look profitable. And when they're not profitable, then, they may make those tweaks in the scheduling system. So you may see some of this, a lot more stress. And when you have a lot more stress and time constraints, it does create unintended purposes.
One example that is cited in this Times article, again, just refer to the Times article, is a matter of 1 month's supplies of lithium, for example. being stretched to 90-day prescriptions. Covered by insurance, the company's incentivized to be paid as much as possible by dispensing as many pills as possible, potentially resulting in overdoses. The American Psychiatric Association has raised concerns about this. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, having a history of 10 years working in a psychiatric hospital, I can understand what a little bit of what you're saying there. And extending psychotropic medications, specifically lithium's been a drug around for years, and it's been quite effective. And in some cases, it is the go-to drug for some patients. But taking excess of the drug can also cause harm as well. I would agree with the individual's perspective in the article that not everybody would require a 90-day supply or need to have a 90-day supply. But I would think that pharmacist, with their relationship with that patient, should be the one making that call, not a PBM or someone in leadership making that call from a cost perspective.
You brought up PBMs, and we're going to get to that in just a minute because it's a very important part of the story. I understand.
Yes,
but I wanted to ask you first, do you think this corporate system that we're talking about that's come into play with these chains, is it rewarding safety and quality, or is it rewarding volume?
Well, it appears to be that it's rewarding volume, but also rewarding the bottom line. So if you're doing, if your activity is associated with engaging the patient and also creating goodwill for the organization, then that is the bottom line of the organization. You know, obviously, as a pharmacist, that relationship, and I'll term it from the perspective when it's your pharmacy and it's your operation. Obviously, we all engage in those type of activities, but and I can say I know many people within our membership that still own their pharmacies, and they take great pride in the fact that they give great patient care and they're knowledgeable of their patients, and they take the time to do that. But they don't have the person counting the time behind them that is for unintended purposes, putting the pressure on because they think they have to, you know, work faster. In those circumstances, things can happen.
You mentioned pharmacy benefit managers, PBMs. First of all, for everybody, who are they?
They've been in existence for quite some time now. When the advent and people started having their insurance cards, and their insurance company started, you know, Aetna started covering medications, Blue Cross Blue Shield, all of those folks. Well, they issue these cards. Well, those are transactional-based cards. So all those numbers on there have to be put into the system. So today, filling a prescription is definitely a lot harder than it was years ago because you have to have all this information from the patient in addition to these numbers and those transactions. So all the information about the drug has to be put in there from their NDC codes and essentially all of that information. Those transactions then happen through the pharmacy benefit manager. And that is where you will find and on your screen when you do a transaction for a particular patient for those meds that has insurance, then you would see what your pharmacies will be paid. And you also see what the individual have to pay as a copay. So that's what a pharmacy benefit manager ideally does. In another case, pharmacy benefit managers say they help save money. So they negotiate with the manufacturers to get better pricing for the drug. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And from that perspective, that better price doesn't necessarily benefit the pharmacy, but it does benefit the insurance company that the PBM works for. Nowadays, the insurance companies own the PBMs.
I was going to say, that's, that's what's happened. There's been a lot of transformation in that
industry, hasn't it? That's right.
In fact, what I read is that the three big players, Express Scripts, Optum Rx, and CVS Caremark, have now all merged with giant health insurance companies. And three companies each partner with insurance conglomerates that now control roughly 8 to 10 pharmaceutical drug purchases in the country. Are these PBMs, which basically is a middleman, right?
Exactly.
Are they allowed to own their own pharmacies?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because I've been asked that many times when we, of course, we as the Kentucky Pharmacists Association are working with our legislative body to help us with respect to the PBM's activities and their negative activities where they've created these fees and such. So my question has been to many people is how did the Federal Trade Commission allow a corporation that ran many pharmacies in many communities without the United States purchase the very company that pays them to do their business? To me, that sounds like a monopoly. And I thought the Federal Trade Commission goal was to make sure these mergers didn't create something that was detrimental to our society. And then I can tell you, this has created a detriment to our society.
Well, a doctor isn't allowed to have ownership in a pharmacy and steer patients to his pharmacy. So why should a PBM be able to own a pharmacy and do that same thing?
Or why should a pharmacy corporation own a PBM and do the same thing?
Now, a federal rule was put into place last year, I believe, by the Trump administration that does force these PBMs to direct some of the rebates that they get back to consumers that they're supposed to be representing. How is that working out?
I really couldn't answer that question. I've not seen anything good from with respect to the PBM activity that's happening in our state.
What do you do as a patient if you don't have a CVS in your town, which is really true in the region we cover? You're in a rural area, or the nearest one's about 40 minutes away. Are you supposed to just wait for your antibiotic, your antiparasitic, your nitroglycerin pills, whatever, to come in the mail in about a week?
Well, certainly I would hope that there's an independent pharmacy somewhere in that area. We've done some studies, or there has been some studies done in the state of Kentucky, and we have about 10 areas what we would call zones that have within a 10-mile radius, there's no pharmacy to benefit that population. They're called pharmacy deserts. And we're aware of about 10 areas in the state of Kentucky that one of those deserts exist. Other than that, the PBM seem to be content on putting the independents out of business so that they can take the business through mail order and the individual receive everything they need. What that would be detrimental to these individuals is that they don't have that pharmacist or that individual that they know, that they credit a lot of goodwill to and trust, and they lose these folks and independence. And we've had several report to us that they're going to close shop because of what the PBMs are doing to the business with the various fees that they've created and clawbacking money, not to the tune of $5 and $10. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
It sounds like this is taking what has been traditionally and probably should be a very intimate relationship between patient and pharmacist and basically destroying that relationship, especially if it's mail order. There's no contact.
Right.
Would you say that pharmacists are kind of canaries in the coal mine?
I would hope not.
Let's hope not.
I would hope not. We're standing up and fighting for our profession right now.
You're fighting back against this PBM movement.
Absolutely, sir.
What about future pharmacists? Are they being trained to function in these high-pressure environments and to be aware of this PBM situation?
Well, we engage the students at the two colleges of pharmacy in the state of Kentucky as much as possible. Most recently this fall, we had our legislative day, And we had a room full. I can't tell you exactly. Well over close to 100 students from the two schools that came to our legislative day. And they heard exactly what's going on, because they're advocates for their profession, too. And they vote. And one of the young folks is running for the state legislature. And I proudly put money behind that young man, even though I don't live in his county. But we need pharmacists. We have five pharmacists today in the state house in Kentucky. And we hope to have more, because they have done a world of good job for the pharmacy, for the other legislators to understand what's going on in pharmacy today.
Well, we've posted the New York Times article as well as a video on the facts and information page of our website, which is esweku.org. And we encourage you, listener, to go there and check it out. It's a very in-depth article, much more than we can get into here, but we've touched on the contours of it, I believe. Don Cupper, president of the Kentucky Pharmacists Association, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So maybe next time you're at the pharmacy counter and it's taking a while for your prescription to be filled or a question to be answered, you'll have what you just heard in mind and exercise a little patience. And if you struggle with patience, you might be interested in reading On Patience, Reclaiming a Foundational Virtue. It's by Matthew Pianalto, an associate professor of philosophy here at EKU. Dr. Pianalto is the next speaker in the university's Chautauqua Lecture Series, and he's going to talk about finding time for patience in a busy world. Thanks for joining us, Matthew.
Thank you for having me.
So patience, we do have a lot of trouble with it in this society. Finding time for patience can be quite a challenge. Having the patience to write a book, for example. Yet, you've done it. The title is On Patience, Reclaiming a Foundation Virtue. Let's begin with patience itself. What motivated you to write about it?
Well, there were several things I was working on that related to this idea of virtue ethics, or thinking about, and virtue may seem to some people an old-fashioned term, and what I mean and what many people mean by that is a character-based ethics, where we think about what character traits does a person need to excel in the world and to do well and to treat others well and to be a good member of the community. And I was wrestling with questions about, well, what do we do when we disagree with other people, especially about hot-button issues, moral issues, where we may feel very passionate about the issue and feel like we need to take action. We often say that it's brave for somebody to stand up for their convictions and, you know, we should speak out against certain things. But I found myself wondering how things like courage and tolerance, on the other hand, and respecting difference interplay with each other. And I found myself at times thinking, well, we need to have a certain amount of patience when we're disagreeing, arguing with each other, and so that we don't overimpose our own views. And I got to thinking about, well, what a philosopher said about patience. I'd been reading a lot about these other things, and I discovered that there was less than you might think that had been written about patience. And I had to dig around, and nobody in a long, long time had written a book about patience. And so I thought, well, here's a project worth pursuing. I don't claim to be the most patient person, so it's definitely personally an aspirational project. But I thought that as a virtue that some people have claimed is a centrally important one and unifies many other virtues, that it was worth exploring that idea and making a case for it.
Am I right in assuming that what you're talking about there is having the patience to listen to another point of view?
Yes. The idea of having the patience to listen, to wait, to hear the other person out, right? So often we want to jump in. I find myself guilty of this when I teach classes. Somebody will ask a question or make a comment, and I'll have a thought, and I just want to charge forward. And to be able to hold back to some extent and to be receptive to what other people have to say, to wait in some sense for the other view to be out there, and then to take our time with it.
So patience is not necessarily an innate trait that we're born with, right? We have to cultivate it.
I think that's true. Many of the what are known as virtue ethicists would say that when we understand, when we want to talk about excellent character traits as strengths of being a good human being, that these are not things that we're born with. Some people might have a tendency to be more laid back. Some people might be kind of hyper or have short fuses. And so we might have tendencies or personality traits, but virtue ethicists will say that a virtuous character trait is something that we can actively work on. We can recognize our particular strengths or weaknesses or our tendencies to go too far or not far enough and then actively work on that.
Do we have a tendency to confuse the act of waiting, and that kind of implies a tapping foot sometimes? Do we confuse that for patience, do you think?
I found that there's a tendency to think about waiting as the paradigmatic example of patience. But I think that they aren't the same thing, and in part because often when we wait, we feel very impatient about it. We can wait in a way that's racked and anxious and be kind of out of our heads, you know, as you said, not only tapping our foot, running around the room or whatever it is. So there are different ways that we can wait. And there are other senses of patience. When you start to dig around and look at different philosophical or religious writers who've written about patience, patience is often understood as calm waiting. It's true that sometimes we need to be able to wait sometimes because some things just do take time and there's not much we can do about it. But patience is also connected with the idea of endurance. When we're sick or we're in pain, we're in some sense waiting to get better. But there's also the act of enduring or bearing with the difficulty in a calm, a centered, self-possessed kind of way. That itself is also described as patience. And along with that, the idea of being tolerant, somebody who's tolerant, you know, if you're a teacher and a school teacher and you're very tolerant with your children, we might say you're a very patient person. And so there's all these, this is kind of a cluster of ideas, I think, that all relate somehow to a bigger concept of patience that's more than waiting.
In your studies, did you discover a connection between patience and hope?
Yes. Toward the end of the book, I in thinking about what the limits of patience are, I raise a question about the issue of hope. And patience has a lot to do with dealing with difficult situations or difficult people or adversity. And these are the kind of things that can lead us to, if the adversity is very great, to lose hope or to not be able to see a possible valuable future to hope for. And I suggest that patience as a virtue of endurance and self-possession that allows us to hold back and to be open and receptive can help clear the way to finding hope when we feel hopeless.
We talked about virtues in the very beginning, and I'm wondering how strengthening that patience muscle, how does that feed over and influence other virtues that we may have?
Well, I think that Gregory the Great was an early Christian pope, and he wrote a piece on the Gospels and declared that patience is the root and the guardian of all the virtues. And that was an idea that really excited me and led me to think about this. And in thinking about this, I thought, well, it is true that the ability to wait, the ability to endure and forbear does assist us in strengthening and refining other traits that we may also value. We may want to be brave or courageous people, but bravery isn't just about charging into a difficult situation. We also have to be able to endure once we're in the situation. We may be interested in issues relating to justice, but often the struggle for justice, for better treatment of certain people, those kinds of struggles can take a long time. And it's easy, and this relates back to hope, to become frustrated or to feel that things are taking too long. And that's no reason to give up, of course. But patience, as Gregory says, being the root and guardian, allows us to maintain what he calls our self-possession. You could say our self-control as we engage in these other pursuits that may also require virtues like courage or justice or even love.
Well, I wish the clock, that instrument of impatience, could show us some generosity, but time marches on and we're nearly out of it. And so I want to make sure that, first of all, tell us about the book. Where was it published?
The book is published by Lexington Books, which is an imprint of Roman and Littlefield.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And available online?
Available online, Amazon, through the Roman and Littlefield website, Barnes & Noble.
All right. And your Chautauqua lecture is on March the 5th. And where will that be?
That will be in O'Donnell Auditorium at Eastern Kentucky University.
Dr. Matthew Pianalto is an associate professor of philosophy here at Eastern Kentucky University. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So tired of waiting, till I met you, but you keep me waiting all of the time. What can I do?
Another hat I wear is as co-publisher of the nonprofit regional arts and culture blog Undermain. That's under-main.com. We host an annual event called Critical Mass that gets people together to talk about issues related to the arts in our region. And this year, it's from 1 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, March 14th at 21C in Lexington. It's free. There's a reception to follow until 5 o'clock. We ask only that you register with us by emailing reservations at under-main.com. Another of our publishers, Christine Huskisson, will be here next week with more information. Also coming up at the Thoroughbred Center in Lexington on March 13th and 14th, The Future of Fashion 2020. Now, this is organized by Lexington designer and community activist Sarita Benedict Begley, and it will showcase forward-seeing runway and ready-to-wear looks from local and international designers, and it's centered around sustainable products such as hemp.
You know, it's very similar to cotton. People think that it's maybe rough because, you know, the idea of how hemp used to be. But it's so soft right now. There's so many different options. The processing has gotten so good that there is some hemp t-shirts that feel like cotton. They're so soft and comfortable, and it's very easy to work with.
The two evenings also feature art and music. We'll have all the details next week here on Eastern Standard. Well, that's it for this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.